Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin, creator of Action News, available at actionnewsgame.com, Robert Young, and Brian, hey, friend of Justin, actionnewsgame.com, Brushwood.
Yeah, man, rather prescient that your mother gave you that name. Crazy, yeah. Crazy.
Oh. I know, like, it really was my destiny.
Justin, like, News Slayer Young.
You know, it's just like, I think this naming convention we're going to need for the HTTP protocol and doing that with .coms and stuff is going to become very, very prevalent. If we ever shift from allowing, you know, commercialization of the web, it could be useful. So I will call him actionnewsgame.com. Gentlemen, we have a question. This is from Everick. Either way, it's a really cool name. Hey, y'all. For years, I've had this bizarre idea kicking around in my head. And by the way, words of advice from Penn Jillette. If you hear somebody say, I don't know what got into my head, listen closely. You're about to hear something interesting. I've had this bizarre idea kicking around my head, and a little while back, I finally acted on it. Imagine a fairly lighthearted retelling of Game of Thrones with all the characters replaced by members of the extended Frog Pants Diamond Club community, like a medieval, realpolitik, non-interactive version of Journey Quest. I dismissed the idea as too weird and maybe a little creepy, but once it started, I couldn't turn it off. Well, that's called an obsession. Every interaction on every podcast I listened to planted the seeds of outlandish high fantasy scenarios, and in the end, I started writing it more because I had to get it out than I thought it would lead to anything. On a lark, I sent the prologue into Jury's One Mic Show. That would be Justin Robert, actionnewsgame.com, Young's One Mic Show, and to my astonishment, he and his audience actually kind of liked it. I kept writing a bit. But now I don't know what to do with it. My first thought was to set up a WordPress and add a new chapter each week. But where and how do I tell people about it? Nobody outside this one very specific community would have a clue what it is. So it's not like I can just promote it to followers of my personal blog. But I don't want to clog the Diamond Club Frog Pants subreddits with constant updates about it or try to hog Diamond Time every week. How do I tell the community this exists without pissing everyone off? Thanks for the advice in advance, even if it ends up being that this actually is really creepy and I shouldn't do it at all. Smiley face. Really creepy looking smiley face. It's like looking at me right now.
Oh, yeah, yes, totally.
Just seen it, but I attached the prologue in case the others wanted to see what this madness is all about.
So if I remember correctly, this is, I would describe it as a creepy interaction because he didn't send me any warning or understanding of it. It was just literally a copy paste block of text that just came into my email, which normally people who write into the Jury Show and mark it as for the Jury Show are asking, they're setting up a thing in their lives or they're pointing out some element that they want to make a point about. This was literally just us in Game of Thrones from the jump. Here would be my suggestion: write it to a point and then put it out as an ebook and market it to the people that would care about it, which are the people in Diamond Club and Frog Pants. And just you know, I think for you as a writer, getting it done would be beneficial. For you as a marketer, trying to sell a product to a very limited group would be very telling. You would learn a lot from it. So and as a way to bring something to a successful conclusion, that would be a far better thing. Even if you charged, you know, made it 99 cents or free or something, you would just get it out to people because if you work hard on it, then the easiest and best way to get it out to people is to just tell them that it's done. Go read.
Can I take a different take on that?
Go.
I kind of like his instincts about doing a WordPress or a Tumblr and doing it as a serialization kind of thing because this is the kind of thing where it might take time for people to get into it, to discover it. And if you're looking for people within the community, it is so niche. It is so, so hyper niche to you know, that you can put it into Amazon, but that really becomes Amazon discovery. And you're still have the job of telling people in Diamond Club, oh, Frog yeah. Pants, here this thing is, go see this thing, go over there, go buy this thing. Where if it's a if it's a WordPress, hey guys, I have a new update here. Check it out. I have this thing here, whatever, because it's the discovery process. And if you just put it up there and say I did it and you're done with it, it's going to be forgotten in a week. Sure. But if you're doing it as a serialized thing and or just, you know, 10 or 12 episodes, whatever, put I would put this in a blog.
So let me take the middle ground. Let me say, yes, 100% do this. Yes, take advantage of the short-term benefit of the fact that each time you release a new chapter, you can captivate a very relatively small but very passionate audience. For example, what if he did the entire Game of Thrones story all with characters from Diamond Club? Each time, let's say once a month or every 2 or 3 weeks or whatever it is, he releases out to the Diamond Time, you know, which gets you a certain amount of bandwidth because we shout out automatically to the rest of the club, like, hey, here's what's going on and this is the latest project or whatever. But in the back of your mind, remember that the number one ebook phenomenon of the 21st century began as fan fiction for an already established property. And then they went back and they changed all the names. They cultivated the motivations or whatever, and you ended up with 50 Shades of Grey, right? So, like,
fan fiction in a fan form.
Yeah, correct. It is not impossible for you to – here's a scenario I could see happening. You send out two singles per month telling the story of Game of Thrones with characters of Diamond Club. By virtue of doing that, you cause all the people in Diamond Club to mention it on all of their individual podcasts. You also cause a bunch of people to want to spend 99 cents per episode to support one of their own. A year from now, you now find that you've gone through the entire story and that a lot of it has changed, much to your own surprise. And then you discover that really all you have to do is change the words of Veronica Belmont to some other made-up name, because we all know that's not a real name. And then repackage it. That's the beauty, is that independent publishing means that you get to own everything and you get to do whatever you want with it. And if in the short term, this would be a fun side gig for you to create the entire story with our characters. We all understand we're all placeholders. We're not going to expect that the king who gets his head cut off instantly will be named Brian Brushwood, even though I'm hoping that's how it was in the story. But go ahead.
Yeah, I read the first thing of it, and it's very – I mean, I'm not saying that it couldn't. You couldn't swap out the names or whatever, but then it becomes kind of a very weird adaptation of Game of Thrones.
I'm gonna say that translation party, the idea of you take a bunch of Japanese and you change it to English and then to Czech and then blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you play telephone game and you end up with something different. What you often end up with is something truly wonderful as well. So if this is a way to practice the art of writing and operate in familiar territory, knowing that you're safe, it could, and again, this is a scratch-off lottery ticket, but it could be the kind of thing that ends up just change the names, change the motivations, and you got a real winner there.
All right, hold on. I think we're also kind of ignoring something that Andrew and I went through kind of firsthand, which is when Andrew wrote Grendel's Shadow, the idea that we had was to put the prologue for it on the end of Weird Things, because we knew that the biggest audience that we could immediately access beyond social media was on podcasts. Podcasts are what people know us for. If you are looking, I mean, look what even he said, the Frog Pants and Diamond Club community. This is a community of podcast listeners, right? So if what you want to do is get it out to as many people that would enjoy this as possible, it stands to reason that the biggest way that you could do that would be to create an audio version of it. Obviously, Andrew had me that, you know, would go ahead and create this stuff. But what we did for, I mean, geez, how many were they? It was certainly Grendel's Shadow, certainly Public Enemy Zero, and I can't remember if we did it for another one, was I recorded the entire thing as an audiobook. I cut it up into, I think every three chapters was an episode. and then release those weekly, with the caveat being that, you know, once it was all out, you could get it all for free. But at the beginning and the end was a place to download the full audio and to, you know, get the Kindle book, you know, have a link for that. So, I mean, that could also be a way to do it, because I think, Andrew, you're right. What you want to do is make it easy for people to be able to digest it, right?
I also don't want him spending all of his time trying to have to create ebooks and podcasts and stuff for something that might be fun for a little while and then it ends. And that's why I'm doubling down on start it as a blog, send it, get it out to the people in Diamond Club. If people are responding to it and emailing you back and forth, then do the other steps these guys suggested. But my fear is, you will spend more time trying to put this into a podcast. You'll spend more time trying to create an ebook. You'll spend more time trying to do this than trying to make the thing good. I run into this fatigue problem all the time. I write books that I don't promote because I finish the book. I'm like, now I've got to go tell everybody out it, because I put all my energy not just into the writing and the formatting and all that. And I'm saying, like, this is a high risk kind of thing. And that was the beautiful thing about 50 Shades, is it was just posts on a forum. Hey guys, read this. We love this. We're talking about this. Great. Now I'll take this thing and then I will adapt it, because it's really got a life.
That's actually, I think, a good fundamental thing we should address, is the perception that many people have that if you give it out for free, there's no way you could charge for it in the future. And nothing could be farther from the truth. Yeah. Like,
sure. And sure. Just to complete my thought, I don't think that necessarily the idea is to do this all yourself. I think that Andrew is correct, that if you have, likely you will have people that are excited about it, reading it. And if you can find people to help you with it, specifically, not everybody wants to read a book for however long it would take to read what you have. So you would want to kind of work with somebody else to make it a community project, which ultimately is the strength of this community.
Yeah. I would say step one is just, yes, do the WordPress thing, put these things up there, put it out there, let comments in there, you know, see what it's the easiest way to test the waters. You don't have to put the whole thing, put the first few chapters, whatever you've written there, see what the response is. Cause the hardest thing in the world is, man, you go through a bunch of steps, you try to produce something, try to do it. And you're like, man, you know, I had a crazy idea about kind of a life on a Mars colony thing. And I made like one 20-minute episode of this thing. And to this date, I don't think anybody's listened to it, because the people I asked to listen to it were too busy at the time. And it's like, I should have done this differently.
And I think his issue was, how do I not become a nuisance? You know, like, how do I promote it without becoming
the answer is be good, because, yes. Because if like when you see somebody performing on the street, the difference between a nuisance and an accomplished performer is basically one being good and the other annoying everybody around him.
Yeah, I think if you're like, hey, I put this here, and if people are like, yes, tell us more, then you're in a good position. You know, if it's like, oh no, not this again. If people tell us more, and you can do your own subreddit, you can do your own Discord, you can do other things, then it becomes that thing. I'm just saying, get the barrier to access, is because when you're going to a niche group, the key is to just go to that niche group and put it out there. I want to advertise a magic book, I advertise on Facebook to magicians. I don't go put it on Amazon first or go do there. I go to the people I'm trying to present it to. And you know who these people are. And yes, you want to do this in a respectful, right way. I wouldn't say, hey, go buy my book for 99 cents. If you like, it's like, go read the blog. You like the blog. And, you know, a month from now, if you got a lot of people liking it, do the ebook. You're set.
Yeah.
Right. This is different than the normal round of advice, because this is something that is still being written and something in progress. So it is a mixture of, like, not just promoting it, but also creating less barriers to actually getting the thing done,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is why I feel like I grok what Andrew is saying a lot, of just like, do it and make it good first, and then all the other promotional stuff can happen when it happens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And let me just clarify the initial advice, because you're right. I don't want to minimize it. But at the point that Andrew and I serialized all the books that we did, it came after Andrew worked tirelessly on it and I gave him notes on it. And there was a world of work kind of behind that. So I agree.
We were trying to use iTunes as a discovery system for it, too. We were trying to. we knew our audience was bigger than Diamond Club. We knew that, and that was, so we look at like, where are places where people discover stuff? People discover stuff on Amazon. You put a book on Amazon, people discover stuff on iTunes. Where do Diamond Clubbers discover stuff? You got that. You're right there. And then if there's a bigger thing, then you use those other steps.
Yeah. So yeah, Facebook, Reddit, totally.
So we got another email here, and it's to Neshcom, but I'll read it anyways. Hey, Neshcom, this is definitely a question for Brian, so screw you, Justin and Andrew. Well, fine. As it was stirred by him appearing on the Social Engineering podcast a while ago, and he was just on the Art of Charm podcast. I listened to all the SE podcasts and have been listening to Art of Charm for a few weeks as the main guy was on the SE podcast again. Long story short, what methods from these other guys are full of S and what have truth to them? The older Art of Charm podcast made me cringe as they are so bro-centric. The more recent ones seem better, and Brian was Brian. Social Engineering podcast is great, but is usually more an interesting interview than a how-to to or other direct guidance. I would appreciate everyone's take on these. I don't want to say Brian have give tacit endorsement of the Disney to this, but he did appear on them. It wouldn't be very cool to have him just be on them and then turn around and S on them either, I guess. I recall Andrew calling NLP mostly BS. Oh, now you just use the acronym. But that could be the Rumdella effect too.
The Rumdella.
Anyway.
Okay. So if I remember correctly, keep in mind, I'm in a habit right now, for those of you who haven't heard, that I say yes to a lot of podcasts and I carve out an hour here or there to promote. Mainly, I'm trying to get a lot of folks to check out The Modern Rogue. But along the way, I did Art of Charm, and I don't know what the SE project. Did I do a social engineering?
The Social Engineering podcast is the name that he was talking.
I've done a lot of podcasts. I'll say this much: Art of Charm, from what I had seen of it, looked like it began as some kind of podcast version of Neil Strauss's The Game, which I found an utterly fascinating book, and I think was really, really interesting. I think, like many people of a certain age, it began as one thing and evolved into something else. It appears to me that the Art of Charm is truly of late focused on its core message in, you know, how to become charming, basically, which I think there's nothing wrong with. Whether it's Scam School, whether it's The Modern Rogue, whether it's The Game by Neil Strauss, I think that we are one of the first generations of humankind who take the time to notice the way humans interact with other humans and bother to catalog it and share it through 21st century means. And like anything else, that can be used for good and or for bad. Scam School has always had a salacious tint to it. We've always enjoyed the notoriety of saying, this is a way to, you know, steal $100 from the bar or from, you know, or to score a free drink or whatever. I've never regarded that as the actual intention of the program. And likewise, I don't know what territory Art of Charm has covered before. But I do know that at some point, neurolinguistic programming came up recently on I just did an appearance on the Human Experience podcast. And basically, tell me if we're in accord on this, Andrew. Neurolinguistic programming boils down to, there's two flavors of it. There's the parts that are basically fancy wording for that which should be obvious. For example, if you model the behavior of the person you're talking to, they're more likely to like and understand what you have to say. And then there's the totally pseudoscientific, let's have charts and graphs and points to things and announce they mean certain whatevers. I don't control any of that, and I don't control those environments, but I do know that all of those people very likely would like The Modern Rogue. And as a result, it's my responsibility to show up and speak the truth as I see it so that I can attract as many of them as I can.
I'll give you my quick take on NLP, and not to be confused with natural language processing, which is another entirely different thing. It's very interesting. I've read a lot about the history of Grindr and Bandler, very, very interesting idea of these guys who were had an interest in computer science, trying to approach human behavior. What, you know, what can you learn from watching, you know, Virginia Sartre, these amazing therapists, et cetera. What can you learn? What techniques can get there? And they have a bunch of techniques and stuff. They fall under the label of NLP based on sort of a premise there. Like any system, there might be things that work, there might be things that don't work. And the question you have to ask is, how do you decide what fits in and what fits out? What does work and what does not work? And you run into a problem if there is nothing within the system to self-correct. If the system says, nope, this is it, it all fits our theory, it's all good, that's problematic. You know, modeling is a great example of that. They talk a lot about modeling NLP, about how you want to emulate somebody else's behavior. Well, when you start looking into actual studies of when people are trying to model or emulate other people, you find some studies that show that some people are extremely annoyed by that and, in fact, have an adverse reaction to it. And the problem with some of these modalities is that they may say, oh, well, you're just not doing it right. Well, what is doing it right? You know, well, we need more training. You need this. And I'm not saying that proper mirroring or proper emulation doesn't work and isn't an effective technique. It's just when you go do these things, they say, do this. It's like eye tracking. There's a lot of stuff in there that, you know, you say, oh, well, this is like, we think this is true or it appears to work. How do we know that this is working? And there's not a way to test that. And it's resistant to testing. It's resistant to that. If it conflicts with their theory, then it gets thrown out, even though the evidence says otherwise. And as fans of Richard Feynman, if experiment says it's not working, then it's not working. So there might be some things that do work and don't work, but as a whole, it's a grab bag and you have to pick and choose. I'll give you an example right now. It's like everybody was big into like power poses, you know, power posing, improving confidence, power posing, doing this. That data, very suspect. That may actually be complete bunk. And that's actively taught. I've listened to people who I think are credible, like, oh, you know, and it's a fact. Power posing is a fact. And I'm like, have you read the studies? You know, I know that people who are in science say it's science, but is it really science? So.
Yeah, but also, I don't know, I guess all of that kind of presupposes to me that there is ever a settled moment of anything, and that's something I inherently don't believe in.
No, of course not, but you have we did a study of 5 people, very interesting. Well, then we expanded, we did a study of 50 people, okay? Now, I'm not going to tell you the 51 is truth and the 5-1 study person funny is false. If you're going to ask me which one am I more likely to believe, I will go with the one with the greater data set. And that's what you try to do in science is you can say a study by itself, an abstract without any knowing anything else about it, doesn't mean anything. You have to know the criteria. And as some of these things get studied in greater detail, we go, oh, this effect vanished because it was too small or whatever.
Sure, sure. Well, and in that regard, I guess I'm trying to figure out who the boogeyman is because like Amy Cuddy's study on the power poses, there was zero study about it up until she invented the study. And then there was some data set and she honestly said, this is the data set I have. It appears as though acting like Superman makes you, you know, perform better. And then, of course, the studies seeking to replicate were not able to manufacture the same results. And then I hesitate to want to roll my eyes or to poo-poo people who believe the best truth that's been available up until that moment. Yes. And maybe you're aware that the more factual truth is right around the corner.
Well, I when people put it forth as I was in a classroom recently, was asked to speak. And the professor before me goes, and power posing, and we know this is a fact, absolutely do this. And I'm like, okay, I don't have a problem with power. I think it's a harmless sort of thing to do, but I'm like, well, there's more data. And he's like, no. And I'm like, okay, so we're going to use science when it supports us. We're not going to use science when it disagrees with us. That was my issue, is that like, I have no problem with the idea, the notion of power posing. So I'm like, yeah, sure, body sounds good to me. And then there's like other studies that come out there. I'm not going to tell you it's not real. I'm not going to say that it is real. I'm going to say that it's not as definitive as it is. And somebody who tells you it's definitive, that I would consider to be a misconception.
Man, that's interesting because to me, that's an artifact of human language being so inefficient, is that we don't have the time to constantly say the latest, not yet peer-reviewed, single product study, blah, 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 blah. You know what I mean?
But Brian, that's your, but I would say that I don't know the intentionality of the speaker. I would say that my perceived thing was this is a person coming from the dogmatic point of view. Now we know this is settled because this is now I was being told it's settled. We know this works. And that was my issue. It's like, well, no, we never know anything settled. And by the way, in this particular issue, there's a lot more data out there that says that maybe it's not. And I don't, and again, that could be refuted. I don't know. Like I, to me, it's open-ended, but then this was like, they're like, and it's closed. We know this works now. That was my issue, was that it was, not.
Yeah. So to sum up, the actual question was what methods from these other guys are full of S word and which has truth to it? The answer is, nobody knows. Nobody knows. And if anyone tells you they know, they're a liar. That's the answer.
Or mistaken. We'll do another discussion on when you're lying and when you're mistaken.
Oh, yeah. No, man. God, can we please stop using
I got to bail out, gentlemen. I have a pick. It's this thing called Action News. If you go to actionnewsgame.com, you can buy your issue of Action News. If I've said anything that's offended you or upset you, the way to get back at me is by making Justin successful.
It's the only way to stick it to Andrew Main is to let the whole world know that Justin's the better one.
Yes. And if you're my, if you like me and you love me, support my friend, Justin Robert Young. Either way, you win, I lose.
All right. Take care. Get out of here, Andrew. I'm sure I actually have a question for you, Justin.
Yeah, shoot.
You had many, many opinions about the Gawker Hulk Hogan ruling.
Sure, yeah. I think it's fascinating. There's a new documentary on Netflix, right?
Oh, really? Well, I suppose that's a good a segue as any for me to pick out my pick, which is the new documentary on Netflix.
What's the name of it again? Nobody Speak?
Nobody Speak.
Nobody Speak.
Nobody Speak.
So is that – I heard an interview with the author, and I was unclear whether or not this was a documentary about just challenges to the First Amendment or specifically that case.
Here's where it begins. And I'm going to say right at the outset, I would not blame you if you find it to be a bit meandering in its central message. We obviously we as humanity tend to seem to love documentaries that are black and white on a single issue. This is not one of those. Instead, it takes what was the most obviously righteous ruling in a in a very strange – I mean, what you have is you have Gawker taking property that they do not own, that theoretically the copyright belongs to someone else, of sexual congress between Terry Hulk Hogan and whatever, the wife of Bubba Love Sponge.
Heather Clem.
Right. And putting the entire thing out on video, on the internet, and hosting on their servers. Them being essentially handed a DMCA takedown, saying, you don't own that, you're not allowed to do that, please stop, and we walk away. And instead deciding that they were going to, you know, take on the powers that be.
Including taking deliberative actions, like removing advertising from those pages, and kind of going into battle mode that like, well, no, you could technically get us for the advertising revenue. We're not going to provide any of that. Like, we are going to stick to this as newsworthy that deserves to be put out there.
Right. So I don't want to ruin the show, and I enjoyed it very, very much. I highly recommend everybody check out Nobody Speak on Netflix, if for no other reason than to ask yourself some very strange questions. Because where this rabbit hole leads to is in some way it begins with what obviously looks like a frivolous use of horrific, gaudy media. And it ends up making, I think, a very good case about how America is worse off for this decision. Because by failing to protect the horrific, vulture-like nature of Gawker, we have now opened up the question of where does it end? And it doesn't hurt that the person who bankrolled this shutdown is now very, very tight with somebody who has happens to be the president of the United States and happens to have made it very, very clear that he does not respect the Fourth Estate.
Well, I mean – Donald Trump's relationship with the press is very, 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 very interesting. And I would encourage people to read a little bit more into just more than just his tweets, because he loves the press, which is why he hates it. That's a whole other discussion. But the Gawker Hulk Hogan thing, I think, is absolutely fascinating. Fascinating. And despite the acrimony that many feel toward Gawker, I do feel that we are lesser for not having them. And I don't think that the blame for them not existing necessarily is only on the hands of Hulk Hogan and Peter Thiel, because I don't think, and I'm curious to watch the documentary, because as a observer, I don't think that Gawker Gawker took that case as seriously as they should have, as early as they should have. And I don't think that they took a lot of the warning signs that something like this could come down the pike as seriously as they could have, as soon as they should have. So this is a, obviously it is an amazing case, because you kind of don't get any more salacious than Hulk Hogan saying that, you know, my penis and Hulk Hogan's penis are not the same size, which turns into a very important kind of like legal touchstone that winds up bringing the ruling that it does. Nor should we ignore the fact that you're right. Peter Thiel coming in and saying, you want to know what? I feel like Gawker is malicious and they are not solving these things, you know, on a more reasonable way before the court. So let me make sure that they pay for it in court, or at least allow people that want to sue them the financial freedom to take it as far as they want. It's interesting. And if you look at it's I think it's very, very easy to look at this, much like the election, in a binary. One person won, one person lost, and that there are consequences to that. And certainly you can't ignore that point of view. But when you also say, all right, well, you know, but also Gawker allowed that trial to be contested in Tampa, where Hulk Hogan is a demigod.
Yep.
They allowed their fairly loose cannon editor who made those calls, AJ DeLorio, to go up on the stage with on the stand with let's just say that I don't know what his coaching was, but I don't know what kind of legal coaching would encourage a witness to say, the line for which I would publish a sex tape is like 4 years old.
That was also one of the surprising moments in there, because as I heard the story, and I heard it secondhand, I wasn't following it very much at the time, but as I heard it from you, it was presented as though that's what he said on the stand. Turns out that was not what happened. What happened is that they took videotape from a previous testimony unrelated to any of this, in which he was not taking the question seriously. So he was flipping. So he did give an FU answer, you know, and as with many documentaries of these calibers, I learned a lot of stuff. And certainly, you know, no matter what documentary, all documentaries are nothing but prejudice, right? And so you get to encounter what kind of prejudice these people have. I think it's fairly apparent as you watch it. But given the case that they gave for, 90 minutes leading up to the moment where they turn their attention to the president of the United States, and then we see clip after clip of Trump repeatedly saying, hey, man, we're going to reverse libel laws. We're going to shut it down. These people are purveyors of lies and blah, blah, blah. Like, it is a very compelling experience, and I encourage everybody to go through it.
I'm super pumped to watch it. And as Obi was saying that Gawker thought that they were going to lose that case and they were going to get it overturned on appeal. And ultimately the problem was that the judge, as I understood it, and I have not seen the documentary, but as I understood it, the judge created very, very, very harsh financial realities for Gawker, to the point where it was impossible financially for them to bring it any further, because they had to pay, I guess, a gigantic
out of pocket thing.
A down payment, basically, to even move it to the next stage, which was just going to be impossible for them. And you know, again, Gawker's a bad martyr. You know, they are not.
It's hard for anybody to want to sacrifice themselves in the spirit of Gawker.
Exactly, and at the end of the day, they do face the problem that, like, walk up to a random person and say, do you think Hulk Hogan's sex tape is worth it, you know, to show? And a lot of people will think, no, it's not. It might be salacious. Yes, I might want to see it, but I don't know if it's important. And I would disagree. I thought that Gawker should not, that result should not have gone against Gawker. But also, you know, this is how I understood journalism going through not only the education of being a newspaper journalist, but also working in it, is that the First Amendment is not a shield. It is a gift. It is a benefit of the doubt in our law. And if you abuse it and you constantly find yourself pushing up against it, eventually there will be somebody who interprets that you do not deserve that benefit of the doubt. And all the outlets that I worked at were very cognizant of that fact. And even if you look at like the National Enquirer or stuff like that, the places that normally get a lot of these challenges, there are very specific mechanisms that they have in place to make sure that they face as few of these challenges as possible, because you know that you can lose any one of them. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't make these benefits of the doubt as robust as possible, because I do believe that absolutely we need to do that. But at the same time, if you look at Gawker's pattern of behavior, they sure put themselves into a lot of situations.
Yeah. And I think there's enough examples in the movie, both pro and con, because on the flip side, they do a pretty good job of accounting for the times they've held bad people's feet to the fire and done so only tool they have, you know, with words and attention. So,
Again, this is not one of my biggest pet peeves in life is people painting any media organization with a broad brush. Every media organization is composed of so many different people that to say that Gawker is bad or Gawker is corrosive, I think is short-sighted. For every time that there was something like the Hulk Hogan tape, I believe it was even under the same editorship, or maybe it was right afterward. Deadspin, a Gawker Media property, broke totally shattered a media narrative that every sports journalist had looked at and nobody questioned. And that was the Heisman Trophy story of Manti Te'o. And that was exceptional journalism that really, was a great example of why somebody that's outside of the mainstream media bubble needs to exist.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, like on a very visceral level, I was surprised at how much seeing the actual faces, like I forget the name of the main guy that got bankrupted along with them. They show him, he shows off his bill from the bank for $100 million or whatever. And it's like, oh, but they waived the fee. And meanwhile, it's like, this is just a guy in a one bedroom apartment trying to who now has a scarlet A on his chest for the rest of his life. And again, I'm, you know, for all I know, he totally earned it or whatever, but man, it got me asking a lot of questions that I hadn't previously been asking.
Yeah. Chaos Star 13. Were they the news site that outed somebody? Well, that is the origin story, for Peter Thiel's involvement, is that, Peter Thiel, was outed by the Gawker media site Valleywag.
Which by the way, they take a good 3 to 4 minutes during the movie to point out the fact that, yes, the title was salacious in the way that all the Gawker titles are salacious, but the point of the article was really much more nuanced than whether or not Peter Thiel was gay. But I'm sure that in no way made it sting less.
And that's Brian. That's why I've revealed all of your personal finances, because I really wanted to make a larger point about, you know, entrepreneurism in America. Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
The reason why I'm excited to watch the documentary is because I don't think that there are a ton of really super clean white hats and black hats in that story. And yet, I do think that we are a lesser media culture, because we immediately had something like that happened to what was at the time an extraordinarily important media outlet that wound up getting sold to Univision.
Yeah.
Chaos R13. Yeah, that's right. It's hard to go to bat for a site like that. I mean, yes, and if you look at and Valleywag specifically wound up pissing off a lot of people, and I do think that article was irresponsible. It's not for that writer, who is also gay, as I remember, to although it might seem harmless to him.
And well, and again, they do a great job. This is why I can't wait for you to watch the documentary, because I believe it's the same writer who says, look, I'm gay, and I feel like it's not right that gay people are treated this way, that, you know, and this is my contribution to changing the way that is. It's like, you know, the whole point of the article is, yeah, he's gay, so what? You know, and instead he's like, what? You out of me as gay? You salacious. Here's all the money.
I mean, sure. And also it's like, yes, and that's not his decision. And,
right,
and,
right.
And, you know, he can, I think that his reasoning is understandable. I think he also wrote a very similar thing about Tim Cook when Tim Cook took over for the departed Steve Jobs at Apple, that, you know, hey, look, Tim Cook's gay. Why aren't we making a bigger deal about the fact that now we have, you know, one of the most profitable companies in the world is run by an out gay man to his inner circle. You know, nobody in Silicon Valley doesn't think that Tim Cook is gay, but yet he's not on the cover of Time magazine. But in Peter Thiel's point of view, Valleywag was read by enough people that it was putting it without his consent on the cover of Time magazine, no matter how out he was to friends and family. So,
well, so when you watch it, I would love to hear what things because again, the things I noticed the most are the things that I was surprised by. I'll be really interested to hear what surprises await you.
Yeah, I'm pumped to read it. I'm fairly familiar of the case itself, but I mean, obviously, there's plenty I don't know in any of these kinds of situations. And, a lot of the issues that I think wound up becoming the argument points on this are the things that just kind of frustrate me about media in general, that, you know, if I found this with even as far back as the student newspaper that I wrote at, right, which is about as penny ante low stakes as you can get. But if I was doing a dumb story about them raising the cost of a taco at the Taco Bell in the dining hall, right? And I was going to interview people, there was oftentimes that somebody would say, "What are you? You're with the Daily Orange? Screw them! They wrote something bad about a friend at my frat or something like that, right? Or there was a racially insensitive thing that happened in the paper 5 years ago that my brother told me about, and that was true, right? And sometimes the claims against us were true. Did that mean that I was trying to do a worse thing by getting their comment about the dollar increase at the Taco Bell? No. Like, you could have just told me I like tacos. I would like to pay less for them. But we have ultimately, I think, a very poor understanding about how journalism gets done. And unfortunately, journalists very often are thin-skinned babies and are very bad about explaining it in a way that is anything else than the shrillest possible. We're like, without us, you'll all die. All of it. It'll all come crashing down. And I think it's a problem now. And it has been a problem for as long as I can trace back the history of this industry.
All right. Well, let's promise to loop back on this in the future. But in the meantime, do you have a pick besides Nobody Speak, the new Netflix original?
No. My pick is, I'll tell you what. Here's my pick. I'll call my own number and it won't be Action News at actionnewsgame.com. I'm very proud of the Jury podcast this week, which was a great experiment for not only me and the format of the show, but also me working with Brian in a different way. And I listened back to it today, and man, did I really, 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 really enjoy it. And I'm curious to hear what other people think of it. But go ahead and check out the Jury podcast. I guess it's not up in the in the main feed, but you can get it on my SoundCloud.
I will. I'll double down on that. I dabble in the Jury podcast because it is one of my best friends, One Mike Show, and I want to see how he's doing. But also, I recognize that I'm not the target audience for it. It was so much fun to come in with the stated goal of playing second fiddle to you on your show and to just be Andy Richter to your Conan O'Brien. And the dynamic really seemed to work well. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was an absolute blast. And that whole 2 hours, I think, is also up in the Night Attack feed as well.
It'll be there soon.
I'm super, super proud of it. And I loved doing it. And also, man, it just sounds so good. That crowd just sounds kind of perfect. It's just that right amount of people where we just sound like, you know, just amazing. So I love it, and I would encourage everybody to listen to it. Praise be to Alan.
Huh.
Well, this is probably the point of the show where Andrew Maine would say, it's been after.
Hell yeah, man. Hell yeah.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.